exposing the motives and agenda of the world's most powerful.
Unleashed.
This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. I'm fresh back from my trip to San Diego to speak to Turning Point USA. We had a nice, engaging conversation on climate and the Great Reset. And we are going to continue that conversation here today on TNT Radio. By the way, we have a special guest joining us. Rupert Dharwal will be returning to the program. He is the senior fellow at the Real Clear Foundation. He'll be on joining us after the break. He's coming to us from London, and he's going to talk to us about net zero, the history of the green movement, what exactly is happening in Europe, and can civilization be saved from the madness of our times? Okay, the madness of our times. That brings us to our first topic today. I wish this was a fake story, but it's not. White congregants say a prayer of apology to Black people for their whiteness. When I was in San Diego, I was struck by how unwoke the city was. There wasn't graffiti, crime, drugs. They didn't have a Soros prosecutor. They didn't have rampant homelessness, at least in any of the business district, tourist district. And when you go to other places like San Jose, Los Angeles, San Francisco, California, you can't avoid it. San Diego, even talking to cab drivers, you have to look for it. And one of the reasons is they're running on vapors from a former Republican who used to be the mayor for many years. It's the most Republican area of California, one of them. And because of that, the city benefits. It's amazing. They don't have the Soros prosecutor who doesn't believe in punishing, who bans punishment on shoplifting. So it was like America of old, or California of old, I should say. Well, part of that woke agenda is what you're about to see. This is clip one, a white congregation saying a prayer of apology to Black people for their whiteness. Roll tape.
Affinity for blaming everything, including bad weather, on Republicans and on climate change, which they always associate together. And I fail to understand how you can definitively say that a complete transition to net zero.
I'm going to ask the white Americans in the room to please repeat after me. On behalf of myself and on behalf of my country, to you and all African Americans, from the beginning of our nation's history, in honor of your ancestors and on behalf of your children, please hear this from my heart. I apologize. Please forgive us. With this prayer, I acknowledge the depth of the evils that have been perpetrated against Black people in America.
Wow, this has been done over and over and over and over and over. This is the original sin, apparently, now, if you're white. There is no end. There's no end to reparations. There's no end to this apology. There's no end to the idea that America was a racist nation founded. I'm not going to get into all the history of slavery or anything like that. I will quote you Xi Van Fleet. This is a Chinese by birth, American by choice. She's a survivor of Mao's Cultural Revolution. She had this to say about this congregation's white apology to Blacks. The Chinese Communist Party condemns wealth as the original sin. Cultural Marxists condemn whiteness as the original sin. The goal is the same: divide, conquer, and rule. And that's a survivor of Mao's Cultural Revolution, a Chinese dissident. Wow, that's powerful. Because as I've told you on this show, and we've detailed, we've even had Peter Flaherty on, who was arrested at Warren Buffett's meeting for bringing this up. Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, two billionaires, directly funding gender identity toolkits for transgenderism, critical race theory. America's homegrown billionaires are doing just what this survivor of Mao's China said. The goal is the same: divide, conquer, and rule. They want us divided. They want us arguing over biological men in female locker rooms. They want to force that on us so that we have to argue over it, because they don't want us to be engaged in the issues that matter. And that's the theft of our democracy. That's the raping and pillaging of our world. That's the neo-feudalism being imposed upon us by these great reset forces and this billionaire class. And that's part of what you just saw, that clip. That's the world in which we face. All right, well, let's go back in time to 1982. This is a great clip. Dan Rather, former CBS newsman, very august, very serious individual. He directly replaced Walter Cronkite. This is a year into his replacing Walter Cronkite as the face and voice for CBS News. He did this story about climate change in 1982. Let's take a look and then I'll comment. Clip two.
Concern about rising temperatures on planet Earth heated up a hearing here in Washington today. For years, scientists have theorized about the dangers of the so-called greenhouse effect, the warming of the Earth's atmosphere due to the burning of coal and oil. And in recent months, as David Culhane reports, research has uncovered facts to support that theory.
Many scientists claim that the temperature of the Earth's atmosphere has been rising over the past 100 years, that the great sheets of pack ice in Antarctica are melting at a much more rapid rate than previously. And finally, that the sea level has been rising with increasing swiftness over the past 40 years. If these scientists are correct, about 25% of Florida would be flooded, along with low-lying areas all over the world. Climate changes could produce widespread disruption of agriculture. The American farm belt might be too dry, and the wheat and corn crops would have to move to Canada. Scientists blame the odorless, colorless carbon dioxide gas for these potentially dangerous changes around the planet. It is the greenhouse effect. The gas allows sunlight to filter down and warm the earth. But like the glass of a greenhouse, the carbon dioxide tends to trap heat so that it cannot rise into space. The scientists maintain that the coal, oil, and gas we've been burning for 100 years have produced more and more carbon dioxide and helped overheat the Earth. Now, some political leaders endorse the demands for more CO2 monitoring stations, like this one in Hawaii. And they share the anger of the scientists at Reagan administration budget cuts at a time when they feel closer to getting definitive answers.
We are not doing the kind of research that we should be doing to determine whether or not these scientists who are so alarmed are correct in their assessment.
And what they find out will affect the lives and fortunes of millions of people, the very survival of cities like this one. David Culhane, CBS News, New York.
Wow. 1982, New York may not survive. They, because of those Reagan budget cuts, which weren't really, we've had many economists on, David Stockman with his Office of Management and Budget. The one thing President Ronald Reagan failed to do was cut budgets. He had like his first budget, had some minimal cuts, but immediately after his tax cuts went in, all the spending cuts that were promised by Congress never materialized. And that's how we ended up with deficits in the 80s. The tax cuts stimulated the economy, but there was never any follow-up budget cuts. But whether it was Pentagon spending or even domestic spending. And his own management and budget director, David Stockman, said the American people didn't want to cut taxes, didn't want to cut spending. Sorry. They wanted all those social programs. So that never happened. And if it did, all those scientists spent years lobbying. And it was just amazing to see it so naked. The Earth's in peril. And scientists need more money. Send money now. Send a check tonight before it's too late. They do the whole, I loved how the old clips, they call it the greenhouse effect. And it's amazing. Al Gore, 1982, already licking his chops, waiting to dive in on this climate issue. He later held, I believe he touts the first, either how he may have been a congressman or right when he became senator, the first hearings on climate change. Should be clear on this one. The first hearings on man-made global warming, because as you know, in the 70s, they had very similar concern before fossil fuels caused global warming, fossil fuels caused man-made global cooling. They were worried about the burning of fossil fuels creating aerosols that were going to block the sun, create global dimming, and then make the earth cooler. They even wanted to geoengineer the climate, pour black soot on the Arctic. This was back in the 70s. I detail CIA reports, NASA scientists worried about this man-made global cooling phenomenon. Of course, Newsweek, Time, they had all the same points, you know, tipping points. So within 7 years of that height of the global cooling scare, this is what they, this was the pivot, 1982. In the late 70s, and I detail this in my book, Politically Incorrect Guide to Climate Change, the New York Times profiled meteorologists fighting climatologists, with the meteorologists arguing man-made global cooling that was happening, and the climatologists arguing man-made global warming, and they were having this big debate over that at the time. So this is just a narrative shift from the man-made global cooling and really 82, and then of course it didn't hit in full until 89 when you had the UN climate panel form and you had James Hansen testify. And of course the UN is really the red letter day, if you will, in climate change, because that's, you had a self-serving political institution that was a self-interested lobbying organization. If it failed to find CO2 driving a catastrophe, the UN climate panel, it failed to have a reason to exist. And they had a bonus. If they continued their funding, they had meetings all over the world to talk about how bad the science was and how bad the claim science was showing how bad climate was. But they also, as a bonus, as long as they could find a crisis, got to have be in charge of the solution, the UN. And so that's why they have all these UN climate summits in exotic locations. Okay, the next clip here I'm going is Bill Ware, CNN. This is actually him on MSNBC. This is not your father's climate anymore. This is one of the really serious activist reporters on CNN pushing this. The climate scare is very happy about the civilian climate corps, that young people are going to save the planet from a climate catastrophe. Clip three.
Bill, you write about your children in this book. We all have children. I have grandchildren. And yet there is concern among the young, much more so than middle-aged people, about climate and everything like that.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, in the larger world, people don't go around really believing. You know, I mean, Mika just led in with a story about ocean warming and coral reefs disappearing.
Yeah.
We see it every day. We've felt California almost drowned this winter with the rainfalls. People say, oh, well, just, you know, that's the weather. But it's not just the weather.
It's not just the weather. This is not your father's climate anymore. Past is no longer prologue. Mm-mm. And we have to get our kids, at least I'm trying to, out of the golden age of addiction and depression and distraction.
Yes.
And with each other in nature. The thing that excites me most policy-wise is the civilian climate corps. The idea that young people from Queens and Texas and the Dakotas could get together in nature, revive ecosystems, or learn how to install heat pumps, make a decent salary while doing it, earn some skills, but mostly connect with each other outside in real life and get connected to these landscapes. There's so much worth saving. There's so much left savoring right now. We just have to connect the dots between the air you can see during wildfire smoke season and the carbon dioxide and methane pollution that you can't see that is supercharging these unnatural disasters.
And Bill, I want to know how we do that. Like, I'm looking at, and I love this letter to your son. You talk about climate change. It's not a problem created or solved by physics or technology. It's a problem created and solved by stories. River, you have a good shot at seeing the 22nd century. And when you get there, I want you to tell them how we came together, sorted out our, I won't say, you know what, and wrote a better story.
That's all that's required. We need young people to volunteer for Joe Biden's civilian climate corps. We need to all write letters to our children and talk about how we're going to save the climate for them, and they're going to make it to the 22nd century, and they can then look back and know that we wise men of the time, wise men and women, saved the planet for them and stopped our evil ways. This is the world in which we live. Climate change is now sexist. This is Hillary Clinton. Women and girls disproportionately bear the burden of climatic events. This reminds me of the Kentucky Fried movie, I believe it was, late 1970s comedy sketch movie. Russians launch nuclear attack. Women and minorities hurt the most. Film at 11. They did all these kind of spoof little quick hits. That's basically what this is. Climate change disproportionately bear the burden. Women and girls hurt the most. Clip four.
women and girls disproportionately bear the burden of climactic events. They are more likely to be affected by natural disasters, and particularly by extreme heat. Extreme heat is becoming one of the biggest challenges to everyone, but particularly to women, and particularly to women in the global south who work in either positions outside in the informal economy. They're in fields, they're in factories, they're in markets, they're doing all kinds of work that becomes absolutely impossible if temperatures get to 40, 50 degrees centigrade. And we're seeing and beginning to pay attention and to count and record the deaths that are related to climate, and by far the biggest killer is extreme heat. I mean, even in Europe last summer, which has the ability to count and figure out what happened, they recorded 61,000 deaths because of the heat in Europe. We don't have that kind of number yet from Africa, Asia, Latin America, but we know and estimate that we probably could measure about 500,000 deaths. And the majority of those are women and girls, and particularly pregnant women who have special challenges in extreme heat.
Wow, so much wrong with this. I mean, she just flat out states the science. The extreme, first of all, extreme weather is not increasing on any time scale. UN admits it, National Climate Assessment. That's not even controversial. I mean, in the underlying reports, there's all kinds of model predictions, or you pick this area here and you pick a time frame. Oh, this area has seen an increase in flooding since, you know, 2008. You can do that kind of stuff, but not global, not 30, 50, 100 year global time scale. No extreme weather is increasing. Sorry. In terms of heat, Hillary Clinton was just flat out wrong there, saying that extreme heat is the biggest killer. No, cold is the biggest killer by 8, 10, some studies up to 20 times more people around the world die from cold than they do heat. So she's flat out wrong there. And it's so silly to say that, you know, women and children are hurt the most. Well, let's go to clip that back. This is from the first hour, clip four, Secretary Energy Granholm finishing the grilling by Mike Lee. And Mike Lee makes some very good comments about climate change. It's great to have a U.S. senator like this. Go back to the first hour, clip 4B.
I understand the Biden administration's affinity for blaming everything, including bad weather, on Republicans and on climate change, which they always associate together. And I fail to understand how you can definitively say that a complete transition to net zero is necessary when you don't even know the impact that it would have on global temperatures. You can't tell me sitting here today what it's going to do. You tell me what you fear might happen if we don't do that. You tell me that you think temperatures will increase less if we do this than if we don't. I don't get this, especially when if what you're talking about is a large number, it would seem fanciful and not backed up. If it's a smaller number, it could be dismissed as a rounding error. And meanwhile, you're talking about completely changing the global economy. And given the way the United States tends to honor its legal obligations and its commitments more than other countries do, we can rest assured that it's going to cost the United States a lot more money than it is going to in a lot of places, meaning poor and middle-class Americans will suffer by far more than anyone and everyone else. I find this completely unacceptable. This is reverse Robin Hood. It's talking about stealing from the rich, stealing from the poor to give to the rich. Nobody supports that. And we can't endure it. America's poor and middle class certainly shouldn't have to shoulder this burden.
Wow. Bravo. I gotta applaud. That is U.S. Senator Mike Lee from Utah just hitting it out of the park. And we're going to ask our next guest, Rupert Darwell, whether there's politicians like that in Europe, in the UK. He's going to be coming to us from London. He's the senior fellow of the Real Clear Foundation. And he is the author of two books, Green Tyranny and the Age of Global Warming, both incredible books. He's great at tracing the history of this green scare and the Marxist roots. So we're going to take a break. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. We'll be back with Rupert Dharwal of the Real Clear Foundation. Stay tuned. You don't want to miss this.
TNT's James Freeman.
The issue I raise is how this year's US presidential election presents a clear and present danger to the world, given the weakness of Joe Biden, the current president of the United States. It is clear that the world needs right now, what the world needs is a US president that projects power, takes decisions, and sets a clear pathway on foreign policy. But instead, we've got a president who prefers to sit idly by, leaving a dangerous vacuum in his wake. What we've got at the moment is Joe Biden being a backseat driver who is trying to drive world affairs without putting his hands on the wheel.
James Freeman on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission.
Mom was always very self-sufficient, but we started noticing things were off.
Alzheimer's. It was hard to hear that.
Early detection gave us time to seek information and support.
If you or your family are noticing changes, it could be Alzheimer's. Talk about seeing a doctor together.
The forgotten poor are waiting for mercy ships. And now, our newest state-of-the-art hospital ship with volunteer medical staff will double our ability to help those who need it most. To learn more, go to mercyships.org today.
I know kids worry about a lot of things. Getting enough food to eat shouldn't be one of them. Through a nationwide network of food banks, Feeding America serves virtually every community in the United States. See how you can help your community. Visit feedingamerica.org.
If you're talking about it, we're talking about it. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. All right, joining the program now is Rupert Dharwal, Senior Fellow of the Real Clear Foundation. He previously worked as an investment analyst in corporate finance, and he's the author of two books, Green Tyranny and the Age of Global Warming. Welcome to the program today on TNT, Rupert.
Great to be joining you, Mark. The one thing you missed out is Marrakesh when I got arrested, as you remember, right. The Marrakesh Climate Conference by the UN police. And they took away and they wanted to go
Rupert,
through
it. Okay. Yes, I recall you were actually there on WeWork for Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow, which is CFAC's Climate Depot, my website. And we were credentialed through them. And Craig Rucker and I had done our stunt with the cardboard cutout of Donald Trump. And we got ejected. And then Rupert is there on our credentials. They banned us for life, revoked our credentials, and Rupert, not knowing any of this, shows up merrily to go through, and he's immediately, tell us what happened then when you showed up. Unbeknownst, we did not give you warning because it just happened to us. Go ahead.
No, I do remember the stunt where you had the cut out of Donald Trump and the shredding of the Paris Agreement, the ceremonial shredding of the Paris Agreement. Anyhow, the next day I turned up and was just going through the securities, you know, that big tent. And the next thing was these great big UN security, these police came up and they held me and I said, there's no problem. And then I tried to get away. They were getting quite eggy with me, you know, quite aggressive. And then they rushed to me, they tackled me, and then they took me to a small room. What are you doing here? Who are you seeing? Who are you talking to? And so I questioned for about 30 minutes. They looked at my phone. They wanted to, and then they just pushed me out, which was great because the next day I took a side trip around the Atlas Mountains, which I can tell you, Mark, is a much better way to spend your time than one of those ghastly UN climate conferences.
Wow, I am so sorry. I mean, I call them, they were armed UN climate cops. They didn't play
they
around.
They have pistols on their, yes, in their holsters.
And they seized my briefcase as well. They sent Craig Rucker and I to wander into the desert. Now, it was only about a football field long, but still, we wandered into the desert when they threw us out because there was nowhere to go. We had to wander to the parking lot in the sand. But that just goes to show you what the United Nations climate summits think of dissent. Okay, so, well, let's talk here. Here we are, Rupert, now. It's 2024. You're in Europe. So let's start with that. How is it coming in Europe? Remember, we were sold the whole net zero green energy revolution as solar and wind not only are much cheaper, they're ready to go, but there's billions of dollars to be made, entrepreneurs. This is going to be incredible. There's going to be green jobs, millions of them. We're going to have economic growth. We're going to have domestic energy. We're going to have clean air. We're going to be solving the problem of climate change. We're going to reduce extreme weather. 2024, is it working? How's it going?
It's awful. I mean, it's just simply awful. What you're seeing is the deindustrialization of Europe and particularly Germany. I mean, Germany, the German economy is completely, I'm not going to use, well, but it's screwed. It's so that the petrochemical industry, the capital goods manufacturing, engineering, it's being wiped out because they cannot compete. The energy costs are so high, and of course, since the Putin's invasion of Ukraine, where you had a huge surge in natural gas prices, and the German economy is essentially dependent on Russian gas, and so a lot of those sectors have you've seen a fall in natural gas consumption, basically reflecting deindustrialization. To your point about the green jobs, well, Mark, you know where the green jobs are. They're in China, aren't they? That's where they went. You know? And China can do that because they've got Uyghur slave labor and they're a coal-based economy. And the coal is the cheapest, securest way of generating electricity. That's the fact.
Yeah, actually, and coal as a national security issue. I mean, if you have domestic coal, that's one of the greatest things you can do for your national security because you don't have to rely on anyone. You can do it all within your country. So the question is, I mean, where do we begin? Now, you talked about Germany. Let's talk about England. First of all, I don't know if you got to see it, but I showed U.S. Senator Mike Lee talking to the Biden administration energy secretary. Did you get to see that clip?
Was this when Senator Lee asked Secretary Granholm, what fraction of a degree?
Senator, yes, what fraction of a degree, yes.
Will closing down the U.S. economy achieve? I mean, there's such a sort of solipsism about climate change politics, which is it's that the U.S. or the U.K. inhabits its own climate bubble with its own global climate, and as if what's happening in the rest of the world doesn't matter because the rest of the world is doing its own thing. And there's an easy way to put this, that the global south is going to carbonize before it decarbonizes. It's as simple as that. Yeah. They've got to carbonize. And Britain is, I wrote a big paper on the folly of climate leadership because the British politicians like to boast, oh, we've slashed our emissions by whatever. In fact, Britain's CO2 emissions, wait for this, peaked in 1972. And so quite a lot of the fall has nothing to do with climate policy. Often as an economy matures, it naturally becomes less carbon intensive. And that's just one of the things. But to put that up as a great heroic triumph. And of course, since 2008, we've had the Climate Change Act, which is a unilateral piece of legislation. It enshrines unilateral decarbonisation, and that has been really hurting the economy. So since 2008, which is the year of the financial crisis, the year of the Climate Change Act, when Britain is legally committed to cutting its CO2 emissions by 80%. Since then, the British economy has had its worst performance in terms of growth and productivity, particularly productivity, since 1780, since 6 years after the Declaration of Independence. It is shockingly bad.
Well, if a climate activist heard that, they'd say it worked. Our policies are working. That's what the whole degrowth movement is based on. So when you say a stat like that and talk about the lowest, doesn't that bring a smile to the climate activist's face?
Well, they kind of shifted their position now, because it's all about green growth, because they know that economic stagnation sucks. I mean, you're absolutely right. For the George Monbiots of the world, they yes. do believe in they do believe in degrowth. And indeed, you go back, as you've written the history of this as well. You go back to the early 1970s and the limits to growth debates of the 1970s, where they said growth was unsustainable and was going to destroy the planet. And the Greens haven't really changed on that. And that's the way I see renewable energy. They know. People like the Rocky Mountain Institute, your friends at the Rocky Mountain Institute, they love renewables because they know it's like a stranglehold on energy production, and it will throttle the American economy.
Now, the reason I asked about Mike Lee, and we also have several others, Rand Paul and Senator John Kennedy. Does UK have strong politicians who reject the narrative, the whole framing of net zero, of the climate crisis? Or is pretty much every elected UK official, even conservative so-called, do they buy into this? Do any of them stand up to him in the UK, of a mainstream party? I'm not talking about like a... Okay. I'm talking about someone actually in power, leadership, or do you have a lot of, and even backbenchers, though? I mean, what's the politics like in the UK in terms of challenging net zero premise?
Politics, Mark, in a word, is dire. So when the Climate Change Act was passed in 2008, there were only five MPs who voted against it.
Wow.
And even those nowadays who in private express opposition to it, they tiptoe around and say, oh, well, net zero might have some bad effects. And it's always conditional, if it has bad effects, well, then we'll oppose it. We know it has bad effects. We know it makes poor people poorer. We know it means much higher energy bills. We know it means less mobility, less personal transportation and so forth for people. We know it deindustrializes, it destroys working class jobs. So they tiptoe around it. They don't have the guts to just stand up and say, this is terrible. We've got to get rid of it. We've got to change course.
Well, the reason I ask is in 2019, you had what was called the UK Fires Report, this whole net zero report, government funded. I went through, I think it was your House of Lords. I went through the transcripts of that.
Yeah.
And I was stunned. And this was a bonkers report calling for shutting down airports, calling for stopping, 80% reduction in meat eating, thermostat controls. I mean, it was just like a complete Sovietization of Europe. And in the transcript of the debate on the House of in the House of Lords, there was I couldn't find any so-called conservative politicians attacking the premise. It was all kind of maybe gentle. Oh, maybe they're going a little far here, but of course we all care about climate. What is the story? Why is the UK politicians like that? And can you give us a little light on whether that UK fires report is actually being implemented in the UK?
Well, It is being implemented in the sense that the government has a legal duty to do what it can to reach net zero emissions in 2050. And if it doesn't put in place policies to achieve that, Greenpeace, NGOs, green energy suppliers can take the government to court and get the courts to judicially review the government's policy. So unless you get rid of the Climate Change Act, those are the kind of policies that will be implemented. And it comes under the horrible rubric of behavioral change. You know, what you eat, where you can fly to, you have to walk rather than use your car and so forth. And that will happen. It hasn't been implemented yet. But to give you an idea, the Energy Act 2023, which was passed last year, it gives the Secretary of State the power to make regulations to require devices such as washing machines, aircon, boilers, air pumps, and that sort of thing, to have a device that communicates with the grid so they can be turned off at the flick of the switch. So all this is happening. It's on track to be happening. And to your question, does anyone oppose this? I mean, the short answer is no. that the political culture, and this is the big difference, this is a big difference in the United States, the political culture is on board with net zero, and there are people, as you said, pussyfoot around and say, well, this looks a little bit extreme. And well, to give you an example, Rishi Sunak made a big song and dance about he was going to push back the deadline for banning sales of internal combustion cars. But what he did, so it went back from 2030 to 2035, and a big, you know, big song and dance about that. But what he didn't say was that the mandates to increase the proportion of EVs in sales, and the automakers get fined if they don't sell enough EVs, he didn't get rid of that. So it's all perform, insofar as there's been any softening, it's entirely performative.
I mean, this is, let's go back to early 90s with the fall of the Soviet Union, late 80s. Let's go back to Thatcher, Reagan. If anyone thought these kind of controls would be imposed on the once free West, wouldn't this just be called Marxism? The idea is you have a central planner come in, we all have to meet these goals. It's like a Stalin's agricultural reforms or Mao's farming reforms. How did we get to the point where an entire public is compliant? In the words here, I think it was the name was Hoyle, who said he was amazed at how compliant, Lindsay Hoyle, how compliant the public was during COVID. And now is the time to move on climate while the public was so accepting of the science. But how did this happen to the once free West? And I'm talking just beyond England. We've all accepted this, you know, in every major society, at least here in the United States and all 50 states, no one voted for the aforementioned gas-powered car bans. These are being imposed through unelected bureaucracies, through executive orders, through the cabinet agencies by unelected bureaucrats. How in the world did the once free West fall prey to this, where we're all just literally centrally planning, destroying, voluntarily destroying ourselves for some goal of saving the climate? How? How did it happen? I mean, it seems like it happened on a dime, you know, at least it happened, you know, since 9/11 or something. I think 9/11 accelerated our willingness to accept government propaganda in terms of giving up our freedom to keep us safe.
I'll tell you, actually, I'm writing a book about this. It's my third book. The title is Age of Error. And what's Age really interesting, Age of Error, good one, isn't it? What's really interesting is the G8 in 2006, the G8 had a meeting in St. Petersburg, and it produced the St. Petersburg Energy Security Package. And in that, it said there was a concern about very high oil prices then and the harm it was doing the economy. And the G8 signed up to this package, which said we got to invest trillions of dollars in oil production and exploration. Okay. So that was sanity. That was when the globe, the West was sane. You then had the financial crisis, 2007, 2008. And out of that, when you come to 2009, the G8, which was in Italy, it was all about green. It was about green growth. We've got to invest in renewables. We've got to hit these. And it was very much, I think Barack Obama has a lot to blame for what happened. And then we had the Paris Agreement 2015, and that we got this, we were fed on net zero. And so like the mania has intensified, and net zero, I think, was a really, it's terrible. It's a terrible policy, but it kind of accelerated this descent into insanity, frankly. But it's fairly recent. You're absolutely right. It's like the frog in boiling water. That's what's happened. And the heat's just got turned up.
I mean, if you look at this as a big picture, and let's go through it one at a time. You have the intentional collapse, rationing of energy, food, transportation, freedom of movement. So let's start with energy then. Let's just go throughout. We'll stick with Europe. So you mentioned Germany. You talked a little bit about England. I mean, how does it look? How is France doing? They have the most nuclear of any nation there. So how are they doing? Are they weathering this energy attempts? Are they doing pretty well? I know they recently banned airline flights at 2.5 hours or less to save the climate. That was insane last spring. But I mean, are they the least affected of all the European countries because of their nuclear percentages?
Yeah, I mean, theoretically they are. They also had, what you had, as we know, was the gilets jaunes in Macron's first term.
Yeah, yellow vest.
The yellow vest and sort of the popular rural small town revolt against this kind of stuff, which has softened They have a minister for the ecological transition. That shows how balmy Macron was at that time. And there's definitely been a softening. And when he was first elected, he was for reducing the amount of nuclear power and increasing the proportion of renewables. And he's gone back on that. He wants to have more nuclear power and he's less in favor of renewables. So, yes, France looks a bit better. The big change has been in the Netherlands, which is one of the biggest agricultural exporters in the EU. And they had that campaign against farming because farming is so emits so many greenhouse gases, and they've got this obsession with nitrogen. And there you saw a big in the last parliamentary elections, a big upset. Germany, we've talked about, it's absolutely devastating their industrial base. I'm surprised that the geopolitical, the threat from the East, as it were, has not been a moment of realism. So when Liz Truss replaced Boris Johnson as prime minister for those 59 days or whatever of her premiership, if she had been foreign secretary, she should have got off on her hind legs and said, look, there's been a fundamental change in the geopolitical. We can't do this stuff anymore. What comes first? Is it defending ourselves or is it going to net zero? But no politician, no European politician has made that argument. And until they do make that argument, Mark, it's just going to continue as badly as it is.
Wow. All right. We're talking with Rupert Darwell, senior fellow at the Real Clear Foundation, author of the book Green Tyranny and the book The Age of Global Warming. We got to take a break. We'll be right back. I want to ask you about the intentional rationing of food and your freedom of movement when we come back. This is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. Stay tuned.
When a crisis hits, close to home and across the globe, nonprofits are on the front lines, ready to serve.
Keep coming.
The demand for charitable services has skyrocketed, and nonprofits are rising to meet the needs. Healing. Nurturing. Rescuing. Honoring. Protecting. Caring. Inspiring. The work of philanthropic organizations of all sizes, across all missions, has never been more important. And it's donors and volunteers like you who make all this possible. Thank you. Together, we change the world. The Nonprofit Alliance.
Eggs. You can fry them, scramble them, poach them, boil them, or race them on a spoon. But uncooked eggs can be a risk for food poisoning. To be safe, avoid buying dirty or cracked eggs. Always wash your hands after handling eggs. And if you're concerned, pregnant, elderly, or have a poor immune system, make sure you cook eggs until the yolk starts to firm. Or look for new pasteurized eggs. For excellent eggs, handle them safely.
Mark Morano is unleashed, and he's taking on the World Economic Forum, the World Health Organization, and the United Nations on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
TNT. Welcome back to Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. We're talking with Rupert Darwell, senior fellow of the Real Clear Foundation, and author of the two books, Green Tyranny and the Age of Global Warming. And my old friend from UN Climate Summits, as he mentioned, he got arrested. All right, Rupert, let's talk about agricultural policy. You mentioned the Netherlands. They seem to be going after two key things with agriculture. When I say they, I mean the net zero climate agenda. They're going after nitrogen-based fertilizer because they said the effects of nitrous oxide on the climate are devastating. And so essentially climate compliance costs, in the case of the Netherlands, up to 10,000 small, medium farms would not be able to afford those climate compliance costs. They're also coming after methane. Because of animal agriculture. And you have people like George Monbiot who wants to end all farming, period. And people like Bill Gates, by the way, literally the number one farmland owner in the U.S., want to move food production from farms, crop production, to the laboratory, meat production. He and Richard Branson, two billionaires, invested in lab-grown meat grown in stem cells in a petri dish, put into a steel vat, printed on a 3D printer. That's all true. And it was approved for human consumption now. And they're also, of course, pushing insect eating. But let's talk about that. First of all, the premise is, what is happening to European agriculture? I know the farmers protested. I know there's an election coming up of EU, and I know the EU voted to halt at least a key aspect of the Green New Deal based on the farmers' protests. So tell us what's happening, and is there hope, and are the farmers our greatest hope for fighting back on the net zero agenda?
Yeah, the farmers have changed the political weather in the Netherlands and in Germany. Ireland's got a big farming community. They were told, the government there was trying to say, you've got to slash the heads of cattle by a third, and so there's a big pushback on that. But that hasn't fundamentally changed the direction of policy. No one's saying, well, actually, we can't do net zero, or net zero is a really bad idea. And until you get until a government really collapses over it and really shifts position and comes and says, we can't do this. This is bad for our country. It's bad for for farmers. It's bad for our diets and so forth. You're not going to get a change. And that's where Europe is so different from the United States. You don't get Mark Maranos in Europe.
Well, I mean, if the U.S. leads the way, say Donald Trump's reelected. Well, we've already been through this. Let's reverse the question. Did it help when Trump was elected? Did any European leaders, did any parliament members and EU, did anyone draw strength from that and start pushing back? Do we impact what happens in Europe, in the U.S. here?
I think a reelected Donald Trump back in the White House will have an effect. And I think the British Tories, who are going to lose the next election, which will be around about the time of the American election, a few days afterwards, they're going to be absolutely monstered in the election. I mean, they're 20 points behind in the polls. And I think that will lead to a change. I think the Conservative Party in opposition will smell the coffee and say, well, this is that. We can't do this. What they haven't done is join the dots between their unpopularity, austerity, high taxes, everyone feeling miserable, and net zero and the lamentable state of the economy. They haven't joined that all up. And when that happens, and they've got to do it, I think things will change. But as I said in the last segment, the British economy has had its worst performance in terms of growth and productivity since 1780. And if you're a politician, the thing that you want, this is something Donald Trump absolutely gets, the thing you want if you're a politician is a strong economy. And then everything else is possible. A weak economy, one that's stagnating, you're doomed. And that's what happened to the Labour Party. They are trapped by net zero, which is obviously what gives the Conservatives an opportunity if they have the two brain cells to put together and do that.
Yeah, it's amazing. All right, let's go over to the freedom of movement. Now, I mentioned France, 2.5-hour flight ban, the banning of gas-powered cars, the mandating of the electric cars. You also have the climate compliance costs on just generally on airlines in general. You have CNN recently came out calling for carbon passports for people to be able to fly. In other words, something that would be like a Chinese social credit system, monitor your car and train and airline travel, and you'd be assigned a sort of score or carbon footprint, and you'd have to work within that budget. What is going on? You know, talk to us about Europe in terms of the electric cars and in terms of airline restrictions. I hear that Germany and EU was even considering these short haul flight bans. Is that coming? And are 15-minute cities, are people going to put up with this?
Well, what you have with aviation is you have mandates for what they call sustainable aviation fuel, which has essentially priced European airlines out of flying to the Far East. So, if you look at European based airlines, their routes to the Far East, other than perhaps to Singapore and Australia, they've cut those. And if you want to fly there, you basically fly to Dubai, or you fly to one of the big Gulf carriers, and you interline there. And so that's essentially European airlines can't compete. And so what you'll have on the short haul, you'll have them. The way they do it is through sustainable aviation fuel mandates, which basically prices people off flying. So that's how it's creeping stuff. It's less, oh, we're going to ban you from doing stuff. They just push up the cost so it becomes unaffordable.
And what about in Oxford, this 15-minute city? Now, every time anyone talks about a 15-minute city, you get hit with a fact check. It's called a conspiracy theory. But I've actually read some of the fact checks, and it looks like you can leave something like 94 times, and then you might face a fee. The idea, it sounds fine. A lot of people move to urban areas to be within 15 minutes of everything, your job, schools, apartment. But is this, do you see this as spreading across? Is this their ultimate goal, and to strip us of transportation to sort of lock us into little East Berlin style sectors? Or what is the future of freedom of movement in Europe?
So what those 15-minute cities, you mentioned Oxford, what they have is they have cameras taking pictures of the vehicle registration plate. And as you say, if you've got a certain number of free passes out of where you live, and after that, you start paying it. You basically start, you're fined. You're basically
That's
fined.
Horrifying. That's horrifying.
And the idea that everything you need is within a 15-minute walking is completely bonkers. And there is a popular pushback against that. So when it wasn't in the big change in it's when Boris Johnson resigned from Parliament, and there was a by-election in Uxbridge, which is a constituency in West London, just under the Heathrow flight path. And the Tories, it's the one by-election victory they've had because they campaigned very strongly against the ULEZ charge, which is the ultra-low emission zone, which is if you've got a slightly old car or you've got a diesel auto, you have to pay. It's the equivalent of about $15 every day. Every time you use your car, it's a $15 ticket you have to pay. And there's people living in the suburbs of London. They didn't like it at all. But Labour's going to win the next election, and there's going to be more of this stuff. They can't help themselves. That's just the way they see it. And it does come to what you say about control, about controlling people and what they do and fundamentally changing how they live.
All right. Well, in our final, we have about 2 minutes left. You've written a lot about the history of this green movement. I mean, this has to be, if you're going back, say, 70 years, 50 years, looking and you're a green, you're behind this whole thing, you're looking at the planning. It's pretty darn successful, don't you think? The whole green movement beginning back, we can go back to the overpopulation scare. They had very similar solutions to prevent that. The same type of everything's always sovereignty limiting treaties, wealth redistribution, central planning, degrowth of some sort. So in 2024, they're just wildly successful in implementing the agenda. The results are, of course, disastrous. Where does it end? That's my question to you. Are we going to be here 5 years from now? Are we going to be further down this road? Are we going to be here 10 years? Are we going to have our own Western style break somehow? Kind of like will it be a collapse similar to what we saw in the Soviet Union? Or will it be similar to Sri Lanka? I mean, or do we just slowly evolve out of the green nonsense? How does it work?
I think how it could end, I think, is basically the West disintegrating and China being the world's leading power. I mean, I think it's when you put it in the geopolitical terrain, you clearly see the West cannot compete against China, a resurgent China and Russia and so forth, with windmills. You can't do it. And it's that geopolitical reality that unless the West, has a moment of sanity, of sobriety, we are on a path. I don't want to put it. We are on a path to ruin, Mark. It's really as simple as that.
Is there a historical precedent for a moment of clarity that we can snap out of this? We survived eugenics back in the 20s and 30s, right? How can we survive this ideology?
Well, I think a lot depends on what happens in November, on your ballot. I mean, that is what is on the ballot in November. It really is as simple as that. It's as stark and big as that.
Okay, I hope you're right. We will see. It's I just look at this in awe. I mean, I just see us as the end of the West. As you say, we're going to be reliant on China, and that's they're the number one global superpower. But all right, well, thank you so much, Rupert Dhirwal, Senior Fellow, Real Clear Foundation, author of Green Tyranny and the Age of Global Warming. Looking forward to your third book. Thank you for joining the program today, Rupert. All right, and this is Unleashed with Mark Morano on TNT. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time.